So there is there's this powerful and insightful and I think somewhat overlooked story that is from Jesus' Jewish tradition. And Kyle and I, the pastors here, if you've met me now, Kyle is my co-pastor. You'll meet him a little later in the service. We really can't stop talking about this story today, and so I'm bringing it up. It is the story of Cain and Abel. Anyone somewhat familiar, right? It's got like, even if we haven't spent much time, I didn't spend much time in churches growing up as a kid, but I kind of still heard that story before because it's pretty popular in terms of pop culture. Like, it just gets play. So it's one of the stories from the first 11 chapters of the first book of the Bible, Genesis. And these particular stories in these first 11 chapters of Genesis they're kind of like the prologue to the rest of the Bible, and they pose like very big questions. Who are we as people? What does it mean to be human? Where did we come from? That kind of, these big questions. The basic story of Cain and Abel, as I mentioned, might be familiar to you or may not, but essentially what happens is Cain and Abel are brothers. Cain becomes resentful of Abel and murders him in his anger. And then from the resulting interaction between God and Cain afterwards, we get this phrase that's very famous and is used a lot today. It's God asks Cain, "Where is your brother?" And Cain responds bitterly, "I don't know, am I my brother's keeper?" Brother's keeper, sister's keeper. Have we heard these phrases before, maybe? And of course, the implication is, to God's question, yeah, you are your brother's keeper. You cannot wipe your hands clean of responsibility to another just because you're mad at them. Murder is not an okay way to deal with resentment, right? We're kind of all on board with that, right? Murder is not an okay way to deal with resentment. But the story's application runs so much deeper than just don't murder. So that's what we want to dig into. And this is why Kyle and I can't really stop talking about it. It feels like, as we've dug into it, you can talk about this on an interpersonal level. Like when we are resentful of our spouses or partners or friends or family members or coworkers, boy, there seems to be a lot that is discussed in this story when it comes to that. We can talk about this on a societal or a political level, like when people groups are resentful of other people groups. There's a lot there to dig into. And so because of this, because we're sinking our teeth into this, we're like, man, there's so much good stuff here. We actually want to spend a few weeks looking at the story of Cain and Abel here on Sundays at Brownland Vineyard. What does it mean to be, what does it mean that we are our brothers or our sisters' keepers? That's what we're going to kind of discuss. As fellow human beings, what does it mean that to be accountable to each other? What does it mean to operate with a level of responsibility for and to our fellow human beings? We're responsible for each other's goodwill. We're responsible for each other's flourishing. What does all that mean, and what do we make of that? I think it's really easy, especially in the age of the internet, in the age of social media and curated online personas, to like be about something in theory, be about something in terms of like the image we present, but to actually like day in, day out, moment to moment, make choices that practice what we might preach if we believe that we have a responsibility to our fellow human beings. That is easier said than done. And so that's why we want to take a look at this. It's like the fact that this is easier said than done. Let's peel back the layers and see. Maybe that doesn't mean that we're bad people, that this is easier said than done. It's just, this is what it means to be human. To be about something is a little bit different than to just say that we're about something. And so let's tease this out. I want to take a look at the story of Cain and Abel. We're going to look at it for the first time right now. I'll read it. And then I think there's some cool things we can draw from it. So, if you will. This is from Genesis chapter 4, and I'll read from the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible, if you're following along. It says, "Now the man knew his wife, even she conceived, and bore Cain. Next, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel, for his part, brought of the firstlings of his flock, their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let us go out to the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and anyone who meets me may kill me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance." And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, which means wandering, east of Eden. Okay. There's a lot going on here. Here's the first thing I note from this story. It's not exactly clear why Abel's offering is regarded by God, but it says Cain's offering was not regarded by God. And this lack of clarity is actually really important, I think, to us making some meaning out of the story. So some scholars of the Bible and of ancient peoples have suggested that to ancient audiences, the original audiences of these stories, it would have been understood that Abel's offering of, it says, fat portions from the firstlings of his flock of sheep would have showed more devotion than the offering that Cain gives, the fruit of the ground. And that's why Abel's offering was regarded and Cain's wasn't. That's what some scholars have suggested. But other scholars say that the description of the brother's offering are really just about what they did for a living. Like it says at the beginning, Abel was a herder of sheep and Cain was a farmer. And so what else could they have offered? We're not actually supposed to read into that. It's just that they offered what they did. And so it's not what one's was of greater quality. Another interpretation from some scholars is that God's preference for Abel instead of for his older brother Cain is a part of a theme throughout the Jewish Bible of God upending human conventions, like patriarchy or primogeniture. If anybody, that word is like the firstborn son is the one that gets all of the status and all of the inheritance. And so this is an example of God favoring a younger son, which kind of goes up against that convention, which was all over the place in the ancient world and largely still all over the world today. But then again, other scholars think that that's reading something into the text that's not there. And so really, where we're left in terms of what people have read about this story for centuries is it's not exactly clear. There's a lot of different arguments, and there's no real consensus on why was Abel's offering regarded and Cain's wasn't. That is interesting. Now, I don't think that like lack of clarity is to suggest that like God is arbitrary. Like, oh, God's just going to do what he does. In the story, we can see like God has a very consistent ethic. It's about like nonviolence. Like he's grieved when Cain kills his brother, and then he's so grieved by violence that later he protects Cain the murderer so that more violence doesn't happen. So God isn't arbitrary here. There's something consistent about what he's doing. I think the reason that we don't have a clear answer to give about why one brother's offering was better than the others is because that's not actually the point of the story. That when we set that aside, the wondering, oh, that's just, I don't know, what becomes the emphasis of the story is Cain's response to the fact that his brother's offering was favored. it's almost as if the story is saying, like, an inevitable part of life is disappointment, is being second best, is feeling resentment. That's an inevitable part of life. Sometimes we are favored, sometimes we are not, and it's not always clear why. The potential reasons are fill in the blank. But the real question is, how will you respond when life's inevitable resentments and disappointments happen? And along the lines of that question, there are, historically speaking, two really fascinating interpretations of what does the story of Cain and Abel suggest to us? What's the lesson to learn from this? And I actually want to take us to both of them because I think they both have really great things to say. So take each of them for what you will. The first one. This is a societal reading of Cain and Abel. So this school of thought points to the fact that, historically speaking, Cain's vocation, again, Cain was a farmer, it largely supplanted the vocation of Abel, which is like nomadic herder. So like people ceased to be nomadic herders and became farmers who settled down and built their crop and stayed in one place at some point in the story of humanity. And like all big social changes in the world, that transition can come with violence, where a more powerful party that is representing the new way of life can take it out on the less powerful old way of life. And so the idea is that Cain represents this new farming way of life, and Abel represents this old nomadic way of life. According to this interpretation, when God favors the less powerful Abel, that upsets the powerful Cain, and he's left with a choice. How does he respond to feeling upset? He can come to terms with God's preference for the less powerful by sacrificing some of his power, you know, sacrificing some of his ego. Or he can leverage his power. What it means to be powerful is you can force other people to have to sacrifice. And so he can choose to do that. He can force Abel to be the one who gets sacrificed, and he can get off scot-free. And we see that that is the choice that Cain makes. And it says Cain is left to a life of wandering. He settled in the land of Nod, and the word Nod means wandering. And so it's kind of like it's more a state of being than it is a place that Cain goes to. So in this way, I think this is really fascinating. In this way, the story of Cain and Abel is kind of like the story of all humanity. We have powerful Cains failing to respond to their resentments and their angers and looking for less powerful Abels to sacrifice, to blame for their problems, to scapegoat, to murder and call it justified. I mean, that doesn't even feel like ancient history, right? And so this sets the stage for the incredible act that is Jesus' death, if we read it this way. It's like this early story in the history of the Jewish people, Jesus culminates this in an incredible way, where once again, we have a series of Cains in the form of the powerful Roman Empire of the first century and the complicit Jewish religious elite who'd sort of, in the name of power and money, become complicit with the powerful Roman Empire, and they're looking for Abels to blame for the problems of the world. And Jesus, incredibly, steps into that and says, I will willingly choose to be the scapegoat so no one else has to be the scapegoat. That is incredible, the way that Cain and Abel sets the stage for this Jesus act later. And it shows us, this is the idea of Jesus showing us the purest ever picture of what is the character of God. The character of God is one who chooses to sacrifice themselves instead of sacrifice another. Sort of the reverse of what Cain did. So I find that really interesting. This is the societal reading of Cain and Abel. But there's another, and I think it's equally fascinating and equally great to sink our teeth into. So this is the interpersonal reading. This says perhaps this isn't a discussion of power or society. It's just a discussion of every or any interpersonal relationship ever. Like, people compare themselves. People become rivals. The idea is, therefore, we all have in us the capacity for acting out of resentment, for blame shifting, for scapegoating another, for taking our anger out on somebody else. We all have the capacity in that. We all have the capacity in us to commit violence, right? But also in us is the capacity to choose self-sacrifice over other sacrifice, to make that other choice, to choose to be our brother's or our sister's keepers rather than their rivals. This reading also, like, really beautifully sets the stage for Jesus, particularly his teachings about loving the poor and the powerless, caring for those who are marginalized, loving our enemies, removing the logs in our own eyes before we try to remove the specks in another eye. All of that, again, gets to this point of you will come to choice points in your life where you have to decide between those two, sacrifice another or sacrifice myself. And so from either of these interpretations, the hinge, again, is that question. How will you respond when faced with disappointment and resentment? And in that light, God's words to Cain, which initially, I think I read it, I don't know if you felt this way when I read it earlier. Initially, they feel kind of punitive to me. He says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. At first, I read that, and it feels kind of like, okay, yeah, be a good boy, don't be a bad boy. And that doesn't really speak to me very much. But I think in this light, it actually means something very different. I don't see God saying to Cain here, you didn't do well with this offering, so next time do better and then you won't be a sinner anymore. Like, God doesn't bring up sin crouching at Cain's door until after Cain is angry and resentful. You know, an imperfect offering isn't Cain's sin. Feeling angry and resentful isn't Cain's sin in this story. He's not a bad person for any of those things. Cain's sin is his response to all of this, taking his anger and resentment out on another instead of healthily dealing with it. Cain's sin is choosing self-sacrifice, choosing other sacrifice over self-sacrifice. So what I do see God saying to Cain is it's almost like the biggest opportunity of your life, Cain, or any of us, will be when we don't do well. It will be our disappointments. It will be our failures. It will be our imperfect offerings, our second place finishes. Those are not by any means sins that we should feel ashamed of or want to hide. But the moment they happen, our brain will trick us to believing they're shameful. They're saying, "Oh my gosh, I'm not favored. I have to defend myself. I'm in trouble. I must be a sinner." And it's actually the temptation to go down that rabbit hole that is actually sin, because that is what grabs us and hooks us into such a fearful place that we choose to sacrifice another instead of sacrifice ourselves. That we blame shift. That we take our negative emotions and shift them onto other people because they're too uncomfortable for us to feel. And so the message doesn't feel actually punitive at all. It feels helpful. It feels like God is like shedding light on. So you see what's happening here, right, Cain? And I read this last line, but you must master sin. I don't see it as a stern warning from God. I see it as like God expressing belief, like, you can do this. You can master this. You don't have to succumb to this. I really like that. I don't think that Cain is an unrelatable villain. I think he is a reminder to all of us that to consistently live in a way that embraces that we are our brothers and our sisters' keepers is hard. To do that day in, day out is way easier said than done. We can be about it. It can sound right to us, but to actually make choices, it's just hard. So, I mean, it's a wonderful thing that as a whole, we are not as physically violent a society as ancient societies. Like this story ends in all-out violence and murder, and that was more prevalent in bygone days. And I'm like, it's a great thing that we don't have that, but we are still violent to each other, right? We are still sometimes physically violent to each other, and we are very often emotionally and psychologically violent to each other. And so on the societal side, this kind of the reading, now more than ever, I feel these sin is crouching at your door opportunities, because I am a white middle-class man who's almost always experienced favor and privilege in my life. And I'm experiencing these opportunities because for the first time in a long time, in a long overdue way, the offerings and the voices of people of color, of women, are being elevated. And what that ends up meaning for somebody who's always had their voice heard, always had their offerings favored, is that I might be experiencing some loss. There may not be as much room for my offerings and my voice. Like, so part of my job is, as a pastor of a church, is control over a microphone. Like, literally, control over this microphone, right? And I have a lot of opinions and feelings about how I want things to be said or don't want things to be said on this microphone. That doesn't make me a bad person. It just is. Like, I have those feelings and opinions. But because I am a white man, I enjoy privilege. I can just choose to sacrifice other people's access to this microphone instead of losing it myself. I can just choose to do that because I have that privilege. And if I don't recognize that, if I don't take the opportunity to say, "Oh, if I don't keep that in front of my face," I will basically do what men, specifically white men, have done for all of history. If white men with control over who gets heard, like me, haven't consciously chosen to be the keeper of their sisters or to be the keeper of their sisters and brothers of color, the consequences of that were never felt by the white men. The consequences of that were always felt by those who were not being heard. And this is something that is finally changing in society. White men like me are finally being called out. We are actually experiencing the consequences. Powerful white men are being raked through the coals in popular culture. And so that there's this sudden moment where we are faced with the Cain question. The Cain question as a collective is being posed to white men of privilege. How will we respond? Will we respond by sacrificing some of our position, sacrificing some of our voice, some of our ego? Or will we say, "Yeah, it's not on me," and try to wipe our hands clean of that responsibility? So on the interpersonal side, I actually resonate with this story even more. I'm somebody for whom disappointment and resentment hits hard. Like, that's just true of me as a person. And I wish it wasn't as true, because it's kind of embarrassing to say so, but it hits me hard. I think of an experience that happened a while back within one of the circles of other pastors that Kyle and I are a part of for our own pastoral care or our own professional development. In one of these circles, I'm considerably younger than most of the other pastors, but I'd always really felt like my voice was valued, my opinions were valued, my talents were valued. I'd be asked to do things, and that always felt really good as a younger person among this circle. So as time went on, for various reasons, I drifted apart from this specific circle of pastors. And eventually there was another younger pastor who joined this group. And I started to notice how much their opinions were asked for, how much their talents were celebrated, how much they were called to ask to do things. And I could not have told you at the time, but I was feeling resentful. I was feeling replaced. And the best thing for me to have done at this point would have been to process those feelings of disappointment, of resentment, to do that with people that I trust, right? Like, to do that with my wife, to do that with Kyle, my co-pastor here, to do that with my men's group, to do that with a therapist, safe containers for me to take emotions that feel negative, that I don't want to show to the world, and put those in a place that's safe where I won't get judged for that. I could just, if I brought those to any of, to my men's group, to my wife, to my co-pastor, to my therapist, I wouldn't feel judged for that. That would have been the safe thing to do. But I didn't do that. I wasn't fully aware of what was going on in me, and I did not make that choice. Rather, I didn't want to face up to the death of my ego that this would require to show negative emotions to other people. I chose to try to shift those negative feelings onto this pastor who I felt replaced by. I was cold, standoffish to them. I could have never told you in the time that I was being that, but I was. I didn't treat them like a peer. I did not operate with them as though I had a responsibility to them. I was like trying to wipe my hands clean of, I don't need to be in that. I don't need to invest in that relationship. It doesn't matter that I'm in a group with them. We're all accountable to each other. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to keep my distance. And one day, I was called out by this pastor. They literally said to me, "What is your problem with me?" And that was uncomfortable. It's like, that was the question. I'm not like paraphrasing. What is your problem with me? I've never done anything to you. And they were right. I had never done anything. Or they had never done anything to me. I'd done plenty to them, right? They had never done anything to me. And it was hard to be asked that question. It was really hard to be asked that. I mean, there was maybe a little bit of shock value there, but it got me, right? But I think God used it. Because it kind of like jostled me out of my comfortable little distancing that I was doing, my resentment. I didn't defend myself. I apologized. I said, you're right. Yes, you've done nothing. You're right. I need to figure this out. This is on me. And I've tried like since to make a conscious effort, like going out of the way to try to welcome this person, embrace this person, and not distance myself from that. I still sometimes feel that twinge of resentment, right? Once you feel it, it doesn't go away, right? It doesn't make me a bad person to feel that. But my response to that matters. And so making those wise choices to go to those safe people who I can unload these negative feelings and not feel judged for that so that I don't transmit them onto some unsuspecting person who doesn't deserve it. So I think the truth here is that I just honestly believe that we all need help to do this. I don't believe anyone who says that they're just good at this. No matter how much therapy you do, no matter how high functioning you are, you can tell me that you're good at this, but I just won't believe you. And I think that's because this is part of what it means to be human. Anybody who's trying to do this on their own, I just don't think you will experience success for the rest of your life. I don't think it's possible to do this alone on good intentions or alone on willpower. I do not think it's possible. I think that we need other people, and I think that we need God. I think this is what actually, like, as I look at God's words to Cain in this, like, this to me is, like, one of the most the most powerful announcements of, like, you are not alone to do this. I see that, but you must master this. You are capable. You can do this. It's before Cain has made the choice to murder his brother. And God says to him, you are capable. You can do this. This is a choice point for you, and you can do it. I'm in your corner. And so maybe what I want to hit on the most is, like, it was incredible that I felt God speak to me in that moment when this person asks me, what's your problem with me? And if I don't experience that, I think that I just further the problem. I just perpetuate the resentment and the transmitting it on this person that I was already doing. But I have experienced, like, incredibly, like, an interruption from God, help from God in a really loving and empathetic way. Like, it is in no way when I have felt this is it like, and if you do this wrong, you're going to hell, you know, or, you know, like, this is your chance. I know you suck, so do it right this time. Like, it's always, God has positioned himself on the opposite side of that, of, like, you are capable, you can do this, you can master this. And so a big part of my hope for today is I do think that all of people feel what we see Cain feel. And whether it is on that societal level, big picture things, or it's on that interpersonal level with the people that we interact with every day, we have these choice points. And we're not just left to our own devices to act on those. And so I want us to be able to experience, like, if there is a God, my belief is that that God is an ally in this and not, like, holding out the measuring stick and saying, like, well, you ended there, so I'm sorry you don't get the reward this time. Maybe next time you'll get it. That is just, that's not my picture of God here. We have an ally to do this well because it is hard. And we're not bad people for feeling that this is hard and feeling the resentments that we feel. But we can master this with God's help. And so I think that's where I want, that's where I want to leave it. That's where I'd like to pray. So can I ask you all to stand with me? I'm going to pray for us in that place. I think I want to start with this. I think if we can feel close to the God that Jesus shows us, then that can transform us and make us able to more consistently make choices to be our brothers and our sisters' keepers, to make choices to sacrifice ourselves instead of another. I think we can experience more success doing that more regularly if we can feel God close to us, rubbing off on us. Because I feel excited about like being able to be a part of something that, like, if more people were their brothers and their sisters' keepers and lived this way, we could transform a lot about society. And that feels inspiring to me. But I wonder if what feels most inspiring, at least in this moment right now, is the opportunity, like, that we ourselves can be transformed in this. And maybe that's how any lasting change will actually happen. It's like we don't feel like we have to operate solely on willpower or be our absolute best self or else we're going to screw this up. But like we naturally feel ourselves being changed from inside and we have more reserves to sacrifice ourselves instead of another. What if I could experience that? What if I could have more reserves so that in these moments when I do feel resentful, I can make the more courageous choice? I do think that's on promise for us if we can ask God for help here. So my preamble is over. Let me pray for us. Okay. God, this is easier said than done. And so for each of us, I'm going to leave a moment of quiet for us to call to the surface of our mind right now where this hits home the most, whether that's a big picture thing or a very personal to us, personal to one relationship thing. Would you just call those things to the surface of our minds right now, God? God, the first thing I ask with those things sort of up there is that you would affirm each of us that if we're feeling resentment, like even bubbling up right now, that's okay. We're not bad people. We're actually totally normal human beings. And so I just ask for you to, like, be a good therapist to us right now, God. Like, just tell us, like, yeah, you are totally normal for feeling that. For feeling resentful or feeling angry. And I ask that you would as each of us are sort of letting space for this, fill us up with the reserves we need for this specific thing that's at the forefront of our mind, but in a general way, that we would feel that there is a God who understands and cares deeply, who can come close to us in this space right now as we're praying with these people. And can work on us, can grow us, can change us from within. And we do pray in a collective way that this is the stuff that matters to our wider world. This is the stuff that matters to our neighborhoods and our communities. And so we pray that we would feel attached to that, that this wouldn't, that as each of us are asking you to help make us, change us in the best way this way, but that we would also feel connected to this bigger thing of like, this is how societies are changed. This is how our neighborhoods and our communities and our countries become better keepers of their sisters and brothers. And so attach us to that. Would this feel bigger than just ourselves?